excited to welcome you to the second half of our show. As a reminder, you can catch our show Monday through Fridays at 9 a.m. Eastern, 6 Pacific, with replays at 1 p.m. and 10 p.m. Eastern. And of course, downloading the SiriusXM app is the easiest and fastest way to catch all of your favorite SiriusXM programming across news, talk, music, sports, and more. In the second half of the show, we're going to be speaking with my colleague Jeremy Schwartz, host of Behind the Markets right here on SiriusXM, about the Fed, inflation. We'll talk about the housing market and more. We'll also get a preview of his show coming up next right here on SiriusXM Business. Joining us now, though, is one of our favorite longtime guests, Linda Yu, fellow in economics at St. Edmund Hall, Oxford University, and adjunct professor at London Business School. Linda, a warm welcome back to the Business Briefing.
Oh, thank you so much, Janet. Good morning.
Good morning. Linda, you know, you sit on the other side of the pond where, of course, there have been many major shifts in politics over the past year, but they differ somewhat from the shift that's occurred here in the United States. And I think you're right to mention that there's a greater split now in how investors and those in the investing community view sustainability, view ESG. And I think there was already a trend of that shifting and changing over the past couple of years. But now, since the re-election of President Trump in the U.S., I think that shift has become more pronounced. You wrote a book called The Great Economists. Tell us about the book and tell us about how sustainability relates to it.
Yeah, I think you're spot on. And so I wrote a book called The Great Economists, included Milton Friedman, who famously said the sole purpose of corporations is to make money for their shareholders. So the broadening out of a, for instance, you say an asset manager, into looking after stakeholders, so in other words, the community, employees, that has been a debate which has been going on for some time. And, of course, sustainability is around, you know, looking after the planet. So there is a dilemma, as it were, for companies and fund managers and others as to who they really serve. And of course, as we know, in Europe, where I do sit, and even though the UK has left the European Union, continentally, I'm still in Europe, the focus here is much more explicit on stakeholders and not just shareholders. Whereas in the US, there has always been a split. You know, there are some who think it's broader, and Milton Friedman, who, by the way, famously a libertarian, he originally didn't think the Federal Reserve should exist. So he's very much, you know, government needs to get out of the way, and this is about profit and shareholders. So you had this split in the U.S., and the but between the U.S. and the EU, I think the distance now is growing, because we know with the second Trump administration pulling out of the Paris Climate Accord, which is the global agreement on trying to limit greenhouse gas emissions to below 1.5 degrees from pre-industrial levels. And that, I think, is a signal for moving back towards shareholders and not so much about ESG, which stands for environmental, social, and governance issues. Whereas in Europe, ESG, including sustainability, so that's green sustainability, social sustainability, this is powering ahead, and there are a couple of implications here. When I say the Europeans are powering ahead, it's actually a reporting requirement. It's a regulatory requirement to tell the regulator how you as a company or you as a fund manager are delivering against ESG. So it's not just something that you can debate in your company to do or not. It is actually part of the reporting requirement in these countries, whereas, as we can see, the U.S. has moved back the other way. And I think there will still be some in the U.S. who are more closely aligned to the Europeans, but I think the split is now much more evident. And then, of course, the big implication is if you're a multinational company or you are an asset manager investing around the world, you know, are you able to do that when you have different reporting requirements, your clients expect different things from you? And I think that has actually made it more of a dilemma for investments and for global operations. But I would also just, you know, say that globally around sustainability, so for instance, how you deal with greenhouse gas emissions, the global regime is pretty split anyways. You know, Europe has, as I say, a pretty strict regime. There's a carbon tax, there's an emission trading scheme, so there's a whole panoply of things. But in other countries, in the U.S., it depends on the state you're in. And if you look further afield in emerging markets, there's a big divergence. There's no global scheme. So when multinational corporations are struggling with this, this really is a global, globally fragmented regulatory system, which, as we know, never really helps business when they're it's just adding to costs and you know, for them to figure out what the best way is to deliver value. So yeah, so you know, I think in the end, it's the Friedman approach. I think he's an American, great economist. I think he's probably closer to where some of the Americans are, and I can't think of the European equivalent. So we'll just stay with Milton Friedman as representing one side of the debate, and then there'll be others on the other side, on this side of the pond, who are arguing very much against his idea of you know, looking after only shareholders.
Linda, what is the path forward, right? I mean, you're right that harmonization of these sorts of standards is beneficial for business, it's beneficial for industry. But in this context in which there is such a wide global divergence on these priorities and reporting standards, et cetera, what's the path forward? What is the path of least damage here?
That's a good way of putting it, at least damage, because that is the problem with fragmentation. You end up spending a lot of money trying to do different systems, and that isn't a good return for any business. So this has now been picked up quite a lot, this fragmented, because this fragmented regulatory system is not just for sustainability. We have it in different areas. So it kind of makes sense that a global body like the World Trade Organization, whose job it is to try and smooth global markets operations when, you know, primarily in trade, but I think they're venturing into other areas as well. And the WTO proposes a global carbon tax. So instead of having the different regimes, and what you want is companies to internalize the cost of pollution, because ultimately greenhouse gases are a product of, you know, of consumption and production. So households and firms would actually pay a carbon tax. The problem with that is it's hard to agree what the level of the tax should be. You know, and also companies, it could be a challenge of smaller companies, but I would say companies would often say that in order to become net zero, because that's the Paris Agreement, which is countries have signed up to be net zero by 2050. That's what President Trump has pulled out of. But in the UK and European countries, that pathway is hard to reach at the moment, even if you put on a carbon tax, because to become net zero requires switching to renewable energies, which are not currently commercially viable. So if you take the aviation industry, green hydrogen really isn't commercially viable. So companies are having to buy offsets. So they still emit some carbon, but they offset it by doing something carbon positive, like planting trees, which is their standard example. So carbon tax wouldn't cover the nuances of getting to a net zero, as well as the difficulty of agreeing what is the right price. And I mentioned their households, because greenhouse gases emissions, carbon emissions also come from, you know, our homes and our cars. And if you have a carbon tax, it's regressive, meaning that you pay the same whether you're rich or you're poor. So that makes it harder for poor households. In Canada, there was an experiment in one locality where they implemented a carbon tax. Then they took the revenue and they actually gave it to poor households as a transfer to help them make the adjustment to net zero. So there are ways of doing it, but generally, the WTO economists would say the way forward is still a carbon tax as a way of at least making companies facilitating their, incentivizing their switch to a greener forms, but then accepting it's not possible. I mentioned airplanes. It's just not possible to be green immediately, because the IEA, International Energy Agency, estimates that a third of the carbon reduction required to hit net zero globally by 2050 a third of that depends on technologies which don't currently exist either at scale or are commercially viable. So those are some of the nuances around it, but I think the path of least harm would be to be pragmatic and move towards a global system of at least agreeing what the cost of emissions is, I think, as a first step.
We're speaking with Linda Yu, fellow in economics at St. Edmund Hall, Oxford University, and adjunct professor at London Business School. Linda, I wanted to shift our attention to another important across the pond or cross Atlantic subject of interest, and that's a special relationship between the U.S. and the U.K., which has really benefited both nations economically, strategically, politically, so much over the past century or so. I was wondering if you could comment a little bit on the current state of that special relationship and how you see it evolving under the new administrations.
Yeah, it's a very long-standing relationship between the UK and the US, and I think both countries need to grow, and I think a lot of the frictions and fragmentation that we see around the world, they don't necessarily exist between the US and the UK because the economies are actually quite complementary. We specialize in very similar things, so you can imagine having good, for instance, investment relationships. Or doing, technology supply chains and different markets. Of course, the U.S. is a much bigger market. So, you know, one of the challenges of the U.K. is that it is a smaller market economically. It's no longer part of the European Union. But that being said, the U.K. has an outsized role as an international financial center, London in particular. So London and New York actually does a great deal of commerce. And I think increasingly, in economic terms, the financial services, business services, technology, investment, I think that's the basis of the commercial side of this special relationship. And of course, on the security side, that's a much closer relationship. I think, one of the challenges with the new Trump administration is the possibility of global tariffs. And the focus of tariffs so far doesn't include the UK in particular. And I think partly it's because the UK runs a trade deficit with the US. So the US sells more to the UK in goods than the UK sells back. So the UK isn't, as it were, kind of in scope for tariffs. But if there are widespread tariffs around the world, I think that would be something that would affect the UK. And it's only when you have those points of friction can you really test a special relationship. And so I think, at the moment, I think on security, on the commercial side, I think there's a lot of reasons why these two services economies, by trading and investing more with each other, they could raise growth. And of course, that's what both sides want. But the special relationship for quite a long time has been around, a broader set of issues. And I think, for the UK, after leaving the EU, to maintain the special relationship, I think is going to require a bit more of work. But they do have a soft power asset, which is the royal family. So President Trump may be granted an unprecedented, in modern times, second state visit by the British royal family. So I think sometimes it's gestures like that that actually tell you that, the institution of president of the U.S. and the head of government, which is King Charles here in the U.K., there's a longstanding relationship, between these institutions. But of course, Janet, if you think back to over 200 years ago, the institution of the U.S. president and the monarch of the U.K. really wasn't that rosy. We're really talking about the social relationship for the last century, which has been centered around, a wide and broad relationship.
Linda, just very quickly, in our last minute or so, I wanted to touch on something very interesting. You were appointed to the UK's Soft Power Council. And soft power is one of those things that I find fascinating, right? Because I think it's been one of the backbones of strong economies and strong international political power for the UK and the US over the past century or so. So talk to us about the UK Soft Power Council, how it is that you were appointed, and what it does.
Yeah, thanks so much for asking, Janet. I completely agree. I think soft power has been, it's a very important asset. We spoke a moment there ago about the royal family, but soft power are the cultural institutions that actually make you want to trade and invest with a country and deal with a country. So that was the basis for the UK setting up the Soft Power Council. It's co-chaired by the Foreign Secretary and the Culture Secretary. So that's the equivalent of, you know, the Secretary of State and, you know, and essentially the Culture Department, which supports all the soft power assets. So think of UK music, education, of course, a sector that I'm very familiar with, and sports. So the idea of the council, it's been set up to help the UK formulate a soft power strategy that can promote the UK's economic growth and its other interests in terms of foreign policy. So things like security, things like development. So this council comprises of a few academics like me, but it's mostly the heads of these major cultural institutions, which have huge assets at their disposal. And I think it's a real privilege to try and formulate a strategy that can help the government achieve growth, which is the area that I'll be looking after, because that can improve standards of living. But Janet, here's the paradox of soft power. This is Joseph Nye's concept, the Harvard political scientist. He says that if people know you're using soft power, it undermines its effectiveness. So soft power is attraction. Soft power is pull. Hard power is push. If people know you are coercing them softly, it doesn't work so well. So you have to play soft power. Get them to like you want to trade and invest with you, but not know that you're that's what
nobody
you're
wants.
After, so.
Yeah, nobody wants to be manipulated or seduced. Linda, thank you so much for joining us. Congratulations on your appointment to the Soft Power Council. I would love to be a fly on that wall. Please remind us where we can follow you in your thought leadership, please.
Thank you, Janet, so much. You can follow me on my website, lindayu.com. That's LindayuEH.com. And that's also my social media handle, @LindayU.
And that's Linda Yu, fellow in economics at St. Edmund Hall, Oxford University, and adjunct professor at London Business School. And a warm welcome.